Dave Thompson is a senior coach for the Lanarkshire and Lothian Soaring Club. He's very interested in pilot development and coaching. In this podcast, he talks about the subconscious and its influence on pilot behaviour and progress, as well as coaching in general.
As soon as people talk about sports psychology, I think everybody tends to think about high-level competition pilots and maybe, you know, the kind of people at the top end of the sport. But what I find as, well, in my role, I'm the senior coach in Lanarkshire Club, so I spend a lot of time with low airtime pilots and mid airtime pilots. And one of the things that has struck me is how vitally important psychology, for want of a better phrase, really, because as soon as you say psychology, people tend to switch off a wee bit. But how important an aspect of everyone's flying is right from the very, very beginning, not least in relation to the number of pilots that don't carry on flying. Our turnover rate for members in the club seems to be something in the region of 20, maybe 30% per year. And it's, you know, it's a unbelievably large number of people that come into the sport, fly for a year, or maybe they're members for a year. Sometimes we don't even see them on the hill at all. And then after a couple of years, you kind of wonder where they are and you realise they've actually just stopped flying. That's a great mystery to me as to why a sport that the people who do carry on at it become obsessional, absolutely fixated, it's just the best thing ever. And yet other people seem to just drift away from it, given the impression that it's something that doesn't appeal to them. And one of the things that's become really clear is how often pilot has maybe one bad experience, either personally, and I don't mean necessarily a crash, a flight where they're not very comfortable, where they experience something that's out with their experience, and they maybe don't, you know, I'm not talking about flights where serious incidents or that sort of thing, but just these wee small things. Maybe somebody flies and it's a bit too turbulent for them or something like that, and as I say, without any great discussion, they just appear to just drift away. And it seems to be the case that when you try to look under the surface, it turns out that one bad experience can have a huge effect, and that led me into trying to understand how that can happen.
When you're talking about people giving up, it might be because they, for the first time, face a situation where they don't feel completely in control, and that's what really worries them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm no psychology expert by any means, and as I say, all the investigation and research that I have done has all been really focused towards a flying-related situation. But it seems absolutely fundamental to how we approach the sport that every pilot knows what their level of experience is. Equating two kind of concepts, like the comfort zone, which I think most people are generally familiar with, that you're either in your comfort zone or you're out your comfort zone. But to put that in a paragliding context, you could see it as a pilot's experience profile, which could be measured by the number of hours he'd flown, or what his rating was, or the number of sites he had flown at, or perhaps the level of turbulence that he was comfortable to fly in. And you could then say, well, define that as some kind of vaguely circular shape, and imagine that if a person is within that circle, that experience envelope, then they're going to feel comfortable when they're flying, they're going to be relaxed, so their muscle movements are going to be fluid, and their glider control skills are going to work because they are relaxed and fluid. But as they move out of that, it goes through the stage of being a bit exciting, exhilarating in a positive kind of way. But if it gets too far out of it, then you get into a situation of tension, stiff muscles, inability to control the glider fluidly, which, of course, if you're in a a turbulent situation is exactly what you need, and it leads to a situation that the pilot isn't comfortable with. And the important point is that the memory, the subconscious memory that gets left over from that flight, and I say subconscious memory in terms of the one that you're unaware of, if you like, not consciously aware of, the memory that can be left from that is, that's an experience you didn't like, you don't want to do that again. And when it comes to the next day to have the option to go out flying, your subconscious memory is saying to you, "Ooh, I don't think you want to do that again," and starts creating reasons why you can't come, you know, which, you know, typically you see in pilots who have had an experience like that, that when you phone them up and say, "Well, you're coming out flying today." No, I have to go to the shops. I have to cut my grass. Clearly things that don't have to be done that way, and which, if they had the motivation to come out flying, they would find another day to cut their grass or whatever. So that's the area, that there's a challenge that appeared to be unmet and was clearly an area in the sport that we were clearly not achieving great success, since we were having such a high turnover of pilots coming into the sport and then just drifting away from the sport within the first few years. In most cases, without even having fully experienced the sport, you know, people drifting away with maybe only 10 or 15 hours experience, which, you know, which realistically is even before you've started. As I said, the question that I kept asking myself is, how can we actually practically do something to solve this situation? And in a roundabout kind of way, the answer became clearer and clearer to me. And that is that all our clubs need to have an effective club coaching system, and we need to find a way of helping our pilots to be more amenable to being coached. I'll give you an example of how or why club coaching is the answer to this apparent psychology situation. If you take one of the fairly standard, typical crashes that we have in paragliding, which is the standard spring thermal crash, where a low airtime pilot takes off, probably having not flown for a lot of the time during the winter, experiences a strong thermal coming up, let's say coming up the right hand side of the wing, has a big left hand side collapse, doesn't react fast enough, the wing starts to turn, and only, you know, does maybe a turn and a half and smack into the hill. You know, we read in Skywings every year, beware of spring thermals. And I say, okay, yeah, well, how do we actually beware of spring thermals? And then working back from there, well, how do you actually beware of them? What could you do as a low airtime pilot? What could you do to prevent that type of crash happening? Or, of course, as I say, sometimes I'm talking about the situation of where it doesn't necessarily result in a crash. It may just result in someone having an unpleasant, uncomfortable flight that they don't enjoy. So working backwards from the bit where the pilot hits the ground, you assume, as these crashes happen so often, so close to the ground, that your reserve parachute's not going to do you any good. So that's not a line of protection to stop the accident. The one before that is that he's skilled enough at controlling a large asymmetric collapse and manages to steer the glider away from the hill. But if you're dealing with a low airtime pilot, then the chances are that they've not been in an SIB course, or they're not experienced enough asymmetrics. So that probably isn't a realistic line of protection against the accident happening. The one before that is that their glider control skills are practiced enough and their body is in tune enough, i.e. relaxed enough, to be able to prevent the asymmetric collapse happening in the first place. And again, if they're a low airtime pilot that hasn't flown for the summer and they're very nervous and stiff, then they're probably not going to be able to be flying actively enough to prevent the collapse happening. And then you take it on to the line of protection before that is the actual decision to take off. And that actually then ends up as being the one and only means of preventing that accident or that situation where the pilot had an uncomfortable flight. And if you then take that to the situation of the pilot standing on the hill himself, he sees other pilots flying and he thinks, oh, okay, will I take off? Well, yeah, and there's the built-in enthusiasm that all pilots have. Yeah, I really want to get flying and it seems okay. I think I'll just give it a go. And they grit their teeth and pull up the glider and off they go. And realistically, they probably don't have enough experience to be able to do an accurate conditions assessment to be able to judge what the conditions are relative to what their experience is. And that leads us on to the point of where both having a good club coaching system with a good number of able coaches on the hill and probably more importantly, a culture where the pilots in the club are quite used to seeking out the club coach and going and saying to them, what do you think of conditions today? And to which they can then sit and have a hopefully a useful, valuable discussion with the coach about what their experience is and what the conditions are likely to be, and in that case hopefully come to a joint decision that it's probably going to be best not to take off that at that time and maybe leave it till the end of the afternoon till conditions have smoothed out a bit. So it seemed to me quite clear that from my limited experience, it does seem to be the case that the coaches are in the clubs, they're trained, they're on the hill very often, but the bit that's missing is this culture of pilots actually being happy to go and actually ask for experience. There's no doubt about it, as a sport, paragliding attracts independent-minded people. But at the same time, it has got to be one of the peak sports for not learning from your own mistakes.
Well, I was going to say, like, I think there's also an issue about the profile of the people who actually come into flying. There's quite a high percentage, I mean, obviously I don't have any figures, but just from my experience, the profile of people who come into the sport are people who've done a lot of outdoor sport and who are used to kind of achieving in their pursuits. I think paragliding is not a very physical sport, it's more of a mental sport. You know, you can't just go at it with brute force, but there's a lot of people who do.
Oh, absolutely.
And they find it very difficult, I hate to use this word, but the humility to say, you know, I'm going to have to step back and I'm going to have to take it easy and I'm not just going to, you know, get 10 hours and then fly 100 miles. You know, I'm going to have to actually sit down and work at this psychologically as well as physically to get absolutely the relaxed attitude and stuff. Yeah. And you just can't do that in flying, I don't think.
No, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And that, again, is one of the points that I keep making to pilots, primarily to the super enthusiastic ones that then get disappointed by their lack of progress. It's a sport, especially cross-country flying, it's a sport made up of dozens, if not maybe hundreds, of what you would probably call basic skills. And each one of these skills has to be honed, because in a typical day, you may call upon 20 or 30 identifiable basic skills. Certainly, I mean, the way we typically fly on a grassy hill in a kind of light thermic day where there's a whole set of skills involving conditions assessment, route planning, you know, before you've even got your glider out the bag. When you get it out the bag, there's issues of takeoff position choice, takeoff timing, before you've even launched. And once you've launched, there's detailed soaring technique, where best to turn, gaining a wee bit of height in order to be able to scan a bit further out to look for thermals. And, you know, and then that's maybe 10 or 12 skills before you've even started to experience your first thermal. In your first season, it's just almost physically impossible to be at your peak performance and all the potential skills you might need to know. So every one of them has a potential impact on what result you're going to achieve during the day. That kind of leads on to the other way in which psychology shows itself as being ultimately important in flying, is in the sphere of goal setting. For years, I used to puzzle about how you could almost always spot where a pilot was going to land at the end of the day just by having a conversation with them at takeoff. 9 times out of 10, you could make a reasonable guess that they would land at the place they said they were going to land. And the people who sort of half jokingly would say, "Oh, I'll probably go down and land at the bottom of the hill." Yeah, sure enough. 9 times out of 10, they were there at the bottom of the hill, and the people that maybe equally half-jokingly said, I'll see you at the coast for an ice cream. These people weren't getting to the coast every day, but they were getting a significant part of the journey. And again, that used to puzzle me as to how that could be the case. And again, with the most basic understanding of how your goal setting, and I mean goal setting at a subconscious level, affects what you actually do in terms of performance, it all kind of falls into place. Your subconscious mind has an image of what you're going to achieve, for instance, what your goal is going to be, where you're going to fly to on that day. And that's a subconscious image. So to stress again, an image which you are not consciously aware of, an image that's been placed in there by a very hazy and indirect route. But a subconscious image of where you're going to land, of which you have no conscious knowledge, and that gets compared to your conscious view of the world. In other words, what you're actually seeing with your eyes and your other senses. And the difference between these two creates motivation, which is the driver to keep you trying for that thermal, keep trying to turn, to climb, because you're not at the place that your subconscious mind thinks that you should be. And you keep doing that until you get either there or somewhere very close. And then when you do get there, your subconscious mind is like satisfied, is maybe the best way to describe it, and that its image of where you're going to get to is matched by you looking down at your landing goal. And you land, even if you actually have what in hindsight turns out to be a perfectly viable option to continue on flying. It seems to always be the case that once you've reached the goal that was set in your subconscious, then something crops up that your map's folded wrong, or you're very uncomfortable all of a sudden, or you're hungry, or you need a pee, or something. Oh, there's no more thermals left. That's it. The day's finished, and you're on the ground. And as I say, understanding how the mind works, even at that absolutely basic level, struck me as infinitely important. And of course, there's nothing clever about the understanding of having a subconscious goal, because that's common to sports psychology throughout all aspects of sport, but I think more commonly perceived at the top levels. You know, people tend to associate sports psychology with Olympic gold medal winners and that sort of thing, rather than day-to-day paraglider pilots like ourselves. The most difficult aspect of this whole thing is goals in your subconscious actually get set in a way that you don't actually have full control over, but you do have some amount of control, some amount of influence is probably a better way to say it. You have some influence of what goes on there, and I think most easily you have an influence, a potential influence anyway, in a negative direction. So people that, and you hear them all the time, people that say, "Oh, I'm rubbish, I never get to go cross country," or "No, the conditions weren't good enough for me today," or any kind of negative statements like that seem to be very, very effective at getting in, whereas positive images, positive influences seem to be a bit harder to get in there, but but you still can, well, you still can do it, as evidenced by the fact that some people clearly do have very positive subconscious images of their abilities. And it links exactly with what I was on about right back at the beginning, about every pilot having their own experience envelope. And of course, if everybody just sat with their experience envelope as it was and flew inside it, they would very quickly lose motivation because they would get bored. They were just doing the same stuff. So the crucial thing that I think everybody wants to do is to expand their experience profile, their experience envelope, but expand it in a way that is gradual and as far as possible planned, so that, you know, so that they're in a gradual developing situation. And that's exactly how that's achieved, by task setting. Using every possible opportunity to the absolute maximum. Every, you know, we don't get that many days flying. It's not the sort of thing you can just pick to go out and do any day. So when you do get a flyable day that comes along, to analyse what the conditions are, what's possible, what could be achieved, and then, you know, and being realistic, you know, sometimes you'll get to a hill, we'll say mid-January, at a time where there's definitely no thermic activity, there's a light breeze on the hill. It would be unrealistic and ultimately disappointing to say, I'm going to thermal up to cloud base and try and fly 20 kilometres. Whereas if you were to say, right, okay, it should be soarable from here to there, I'm going to try and do as many beats as I can backwards and forwards along the hill. You know, analyse just what's possible. That's the distinction I would draw up, task setting, with the aim of A, motivating you to achieve the maximum possible, which is where you get the satisfaction from. But I would differentiate that from goal setting, which actually does involve, I think fundamentally is related to setting up an image in this strange subconscious bit of your brain. You know, and as I say, the difference being that subconscious goals can't have numbers or words involved in them. They've only got pictures.
So how do they develop then?
Daydreams. Looking at maps of the potential routes that you might be going to fly, imagining what it's going to feel like to be on that flight, looking at people's photographs of flights, but I would say flights that seem realistic to you. When I look at people's photographs from flights in Britain, maybe flights that I've had an attempt at and I've landed halfway along or something, I think, you know, that means something, all right. I can imagine there that you can see the coast from there, from cloud base or whatever. So they need to be photographs that are vaguely realistic to yourself. So you build up these images so that when you actually are at 6,000 feet looking down on Ben Nevis, as well as saying, wow, something in your subconscious is going, yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I thought that would be like. Yeah, this seems okay. And it generates a positive kind of feeling, rather than someone who hasn't had any of that sort of, hasn't set up any of that kind of imagery, that they've maybe just said to their friends, I'm going to fly over Ben Nevis. So when they actually get to 6,000 feet and they're looking down on it, there's nothing to compare it with in their subconscious, and they end up with a feeling of, bloody hell, what am I doing here? This doesn't feel right. Ooh, and it ends up being scary.
I talked to Anya Koll, and we talked about visualisation, and what you're describing sounds very similar to what she was saying.
Yep, exactly. That's my understanding of it, that the thing that the feelings that you have, whether it's motivation to keep going or, I suppose, whatever the opposite of motivation is to make you land, that's all generated by the balance between what's in your subconscious and what you're actually seeing. And if you've started off by putting into your subconscious an image of, I'm the kind of person that always lands at the bottom, then you're really, really fighting against yourself. It's making it so difficult that it must be close on impossible to actually achieve anything. And yet, now that sounds glaringly obvious, but so often you'll walk up a hill and hear nothing but negativity from pilots. And of course, I think a lot of it is a perception that you'll be laughed at if you say you're going to fly to the coast and then you just land 5 kilometres over the back. So it's somehow better to say, oh, I'll probably just land 5 kilometres over the back, in the hope that when you do fly to the coast, you'll be able to say, wow, look how well I did, and I thought I was only going to land over the back. But of course, the realistic situation is you will just land over the back.
Well, I have to say that the classic example of that to me is people who turn up and they see somebody flying and they say, oh, well, I'm not going to launch because it's not very good. And you think, but, you know, so-and-so staying up. Ah, but they're staying up because that is so-and-so sky god. And you think, absolutely. Well, no, if it's stay upable, it's stay upable. Yep. It's as simple as that. They automatically measure themselves, not against the conditions. They measure themselves against other pilots. And that's a very destructive way of looking at things.
Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of going back to where I was at the beginning, talking about how important club coaching is in terms of helping pilots make that crucial decision as to what they might be able to achieve during the day. But at the other end of the day, and probably even more importantly, is in the probably debrief session, is what it would be called. The chat in the pub that is very much not bravado, there I was at cloud base and a 20 up thermal and all the rubbish that you normally hear, but the quiet chat of, well, how did you feel about your flight, what do you think you could have done differently, and an opportunity to allow the pilot to express what his actual feelings were, because that's the opportunity that if a pilot has had an uncomfortable experience, and let's face it, the nature of the sport is that as people develop, they will, even no matter how hard you try, they will get into situations that they're not comfortable with. If afterwards you can sit down with somebody experienced and have a chat through about what it was you were feeling uncomfortable about and why, well, and perhaps you don't even know why you were in that situation. You might not even know what the actual situation was in terms of what was happening with the air or whatever. And it's an opportunity to discuss the feelings and explain the situation that was going on, or help to, maybe not explain, but help to work out what was going on, which can make a huge impression on, again, this important, lasting subconscious memory that the pilot has of the flight, so that instead of going away home with a feeling of, bloody hell, that was really scary and I haven't got a clue what happened, if you've had the opportunity to sit, usually with a pint, and in a relaxed, quiet and calm way to discuss what had happened, so that you go home with a kind of memory of, yeah, that was interesting, and I now know that I should avoid going over there, and the next time I'm flying in conditions like that, I won't do it that way, I'll do something different. And the whole thing can be turned round from being a negative experience that gets parked away as, are you really sure you want to be doing this sport? It can be turned round to a learning experience which can be completely positive and can leave the pilot looking forward to their next flight to try something different. There's no way in the world it can work if we expect it to happen that the lead comes from the club coaches. The changes that would really pay off is if we could change the culture of pilots to make them much more amenable to actually seeking out advice, to wandering over to somebody who they recognise on the hill and asking a question, you know, general, what do you think of conditions today? An easy way to start, and almost invariably that there's going to be benefit gained from that, but it so seldom happens.
When people think about what they actually want to do in flying, sometimes they don't consciously think through all the issues of why they make certain choices. If they've made a certain choice subconsciously, then having other people around them who say things like, oh, you know, well, I flew for 2 hours today and so-and-so went cross-country and they bombed after 5K and it took them 3 hours to get back and they only flew for 20 minutes. Isn't it much better to get more flying time? That reinforces subconsciously held beliefs that actually hold you back in your flying.
Absolutely, yeah, without a doubt.
And you, unless you actually think about what is it that's making me make the decisions that I am to always do certain behaviours or to not go outside my comfort zone, you know, what is it that's keeping you within that circle that you described earlier, which is your comfort zone, that's not allowing you to try out new things? And those little things can, or those things don't necessarily have to be something as big as going cross country. It could just be launching in slightly stronger winds or taking off when there's nil wind.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
You know, it can be all sorts of little things that people just don't do, and they don't necessarily think about why it is. And if you've got somebody who reinforces or gives you a kind of, not even directly gives you a reason, but kind of gives you a get out, if they intend to or not, it's very easy psychologically to fall into that trap of thinking, oh, well, it's all right for everybody else, so it's all right for me.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's you saying, I think, what I mentioned earlier about how it seems to be the case that it's really, really easy to get negative images into your subconscious. I don't know why that should be, but it seems to be the case that it's easier to get negative images in than it is to get positive ones. That's why it's so vitally important to avoid the negative people that you'll know when you arrive at the hill and you're walking over to the bit where you plonk your bag down, to be aware in advance of who the negative ones are, because they'll be saying the same stuff, and it's really, really important to just not go near them.
When you're trying to work out who you can trust on the hill for advice, you'll be drawn to the people who fit in with what you want. You're not going to go up, you know, if you have a certain comfort zone, you have to be a particular type of person to seek out people who are going to challenge you out of that comfort zone, rather than people who are reinforcing the stay in it, that's what you know, and that's where you're safe.
Absolutely.
Your comfort zone will expand either by people challenging you to step out of it, or by you being so comfortable and so confident in your ability that you can move on, and your comfort zone gets bigger.
Yep. Probably other things as well. Inspirations that come out of the blue. Maybe something you read in the Skywings or something, all of a sudden you think, and not even consciously think, I'd like to have a go at that. Something just strikes a note. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing about it. That it's a weird and mysterious bit of your brain that, most importantly, that you're not aware of what's in it, but you can influence what's in it. So it's a complex subject.